Welcome back to the Public Lands Podcast. This week is our pleasure to host Joe Guidos, Science Director for CDOC, an organization that's at the forefront of research and stewardship of the marine environment. Before we jump into that, a reminder that next Tuesday night, the podcast and ecosong.net will join the Friends of Moran for one of our exchanges in the park, just as we have done this year with Friends of Saltwater State Park and Friends of Limekiln State Park, and will continue to do throughout the year, featuring live events with music, interviews, and conversation with audiences about the land and water that belongs to all of us. So please join us at Moran State Park at 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 23rd in the public picnic shelter near Cascade Lake Beach for that exchange. The Friends of Moran are doing a great job of caring for this special place. Just one more thought before we jump into today's interview. This podcast is based in Minneapolis, Minnesota for most of the year. So I want to join my fellow Minnesotans in welcoming home Ilhan Omar today as she visits her home, which is our home. Representative Omar has been a tireless supporter of public lands and environmental stewardship. Now, speaking of those who love and care for place, on to our interview with Joe Guidos, Science Director at the CDOC Society. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And before we get into details, how do you describe CDOC's mission to audiences that are not familiar with the important work that you do here?
So the elevator story is basically that we are a science-based conservation group. We're a team of scientists. We fund and conduct science. We're not really an advocacy group, so we don't have lawyers on staff. But we don't just fund science, publish papers, and get it done. We realize that science only makes a difference once you can incorporate that into management or policy. So we have this big role that we call science translation, where we really work to get science out into making a difference. And that can be testifying in front of the Senate, that can be talking in front of the Fish and Wildlife Commission or the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, or it could be just talking to the general public about things that they can do to make a difference and where we have information that can help them. And then the third component of that, so there's the science translation, and then the third component is really using that science to get people excited about the place where they live and wanting to take care of that place. And science is great for that because people love facts. People love details. How deep does something dive? How long can it live? What's the social structure? How does it interact with other animals? Those are, you know, we don't think about it, but those are all scientific facts that get people excited about where they live and what's going on there.
Absolutely. Looking forward to hearing those details. And before we do, perhaps you could select out... I want to hear about you first. I want to hear a little bit about how you got interested in this, because you clearly have such a passion for this. How did you get here to Orcas Island? What's your story?
Yeah, it's really funny because the CDOC is a program out of the veterinary school at UC Davis. And everybody just assumes, hey, you must have worked at Davis. How long did you work at Davis? But I never worked at Davis. I'd never even been to California before I interviewed for this job. And I'm a veterinarian by training. And I work mostly with terrestrial stuff. I worked with mixed animals, large and small, and then with wildlife. But I went back to grad school to get a PhD to study wildlife diseases. How do diseases affect populations? How do you determine if a population's healthy? And I saw this job advertisement for the San Juan Islands working for UC Davis, who had a phenomenal history of doing wildlife conservation, wildlife science. And my wife has family out here in Washington. So I said, hey, I'm going to apply for this job. And my wife said, you're totally not qualified. And I said, well, I'm going to go for it anyway, because I really wasn't a marine or an ocean person. I just loved wildlife. And I'd done a little smattering of things, but I was by no means, it wasn't my specialty. And I ended up getting the job. It was like drinking from the fire hose. And I just loved every bit of it. I learned how to scuba dive. I learned all the animals. I learned about the ecosystem. But basically the role that I played as a scientist is being able to take science, distill information, and see how that should change the way that we think or act or you know, believe how things work. And so that's really has been the big part of my job. So I'm not, you know, everyone thinks I kind of grew up wanting to be Jacques Cousteau. I just grew up wanting to be out in wild places with wild animals. And then over the last almost 20 years, I've just become an ocean science nerd.
Oh, that's great. And so how did CDOC get started? I mean, perhaps you could select out one or two highlights in the organization's history, examples of research that added to the scientific and or public understanding of the marine environment.
Right. So CDOC got started because some people made a private decision. They said, we want to invest some money to make this area of the Salish Sea better. And so they wanted a program that was science-based, that could convene people together to make decisions around science that would improve the health of this place. And so so they made a donation to the veterinary school at UC Davis and got it started in 2000. And kind of an example of how that works is I started in 2001. A few years later, about 2004, I got a phone call on my mobile phone, which I'd only had maybe 1 or 2 years, and it was a biologist from the state. And he said, Joe, we've got a problem with abalone. Now, abalone are these beautiful little, one-shelled snails. California has multiple species. We have one species. He said, we closed the fishery in 1994 because we realized that we were over-harvesting, people were poaching them, and we had just finished our surveys. 10 years later, we're going to go back and see how much the population recovered because of the closure. And guess what? It's worse. It has only gotten worse over the last 10 years. And we got to talk. We need some help. We need some science. We need some plans. And, you know, that we can't just do it with the state agency. We need to have some private partners. And so that's how a lot of things get started, just personal relationships. And through that conversation, we did a couple things. We funded maybe 3 or 4 or 5 science projects. Relatively small in the world of science, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 projects. We looked at the genetics of abalone. You know, are they all the same? Well, it turns out they're not. There's 2 cryptic subspecies. So when they went into the hatchery, they were able to separate those out. Second thing we did, we said, after they come out of the hatchery, what's the best size to release them? And so funded another science project that shows if you let them grow up to be the size of a silver dollar or so, you get 10% survival after a year, which is really phenomenal. So it's what biologists call mark recapture. And then we also did some things about aggregating. And then, so we funded these science projects that produce papers, but we also brought together the U.S. and the Canadian people because this is a transboundary ecosystem. And we had a meeting in Vancouver and said, how can we work together? How can we develop a recovery plan? How can we not try and do duplication? And then from that, things kind of just kept moving forward, and a lot of different people took the initiative, Puget Sound Restoration Fund, Fish and Wildlife at a NOAA facility, and they've released about 17,000 abalone and continue to monitor this. But they could never list abalone because the way that the state listing works, they can list mammals or birds, but not fish or marine invertebrates. So they had to do a legal reclassification, take it away from being a fish food, which it was before, you know, something that you can harvest and eat. And then just in June, they listed it as an endangered species. Mm-hmm. And so now they have all the science that they need to recover this species. They've been getting divers and other people to collect data on where they are. And we're just working on one last modeling project to say, how many do we need to put out? Do we need to put out 1 million a year or 5 million a year for 10 years? So it's like that last step, but it's, you can see it's science, collaborative effort, then going into restoration, getting people involved, and then getting forward to actually bring back. And I think this is one of these species we can bring back in my career. You know, 10 years from 15 years from now, we can say, hey, I remember when it was rare to see an abalone. So that's just one example of how science can make a big difference, but it's also science about talking with multiple people, using collaborators, getting the public involved, and then really, you know, forwarding conservation from that.
Ecology in a much broader sense. That's fascinating. What a great example. And I think it's just one of many examples for CDOC. And I know your work continues apace. And this is going to be a bit like asking you to name your favorite child, and maybe you already have, but could you select one project that's ongoing that you could tell us about?
I have a project going on right now with multiple different collaborators looking at skin disease in an endangered killer whale population called Southern Residents. It's kind of crazy. You don't think about whales as having skin disease. But this population is down to, I think it's about 75 animals right now. And there are 3 different pods. They're amazing animals. They work together to hunt salmon, Chinook salmon. And we're trying to look at metrics of health. Some people have a technique where they can fly over them with a helicopter and measure them so we can get body condition score. Other people are just very good at looking at them. They can say, hey, that animal's swimming funny. But these are, you know, so we have a few qualitative and a few quantitative metrics. And we started talking with people that do photo ID. So they take pictures of the animals. They say, this animal is here. So they do a census, right? That's how we know they're 75. We said, hey, do you have any pictures of them where their skin doesn't look right? He said, actually, we do. And they went back in their database over about a decade and pulled out over 6,000 different photos of skin disease. And people have looked at this in bottlenose dolphins and other animals. And so what we're doing right now is we've gone through with a group of veterinarians, classified all the different types of skin disease, and we're just getting ready to do an analysis so we can determine, is this associated with age? Is it associated with level of sickness? Is it a predictor for mortality? So to give a human example, are we just looking at a 13-year-old boy that has acne and it's going to get better and it's not a problem? Mm-hmm. Are we looking at a person that has HIV and they have a Kaposi sarcoma and that's a precursor mm-hmm. to say, hey, that's not going to kill them, but that means their immune system's failing and they're going to die. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty exciting because we're using these photos that have existed forever to develop a tool that we might be able to use to predict the health of these animals and then maybe make some management changes to try and improve their, you know, the health of their population.
Wow, that's exciting work. Looking forward to hearing more about that. Now, this podcast is about environmental stewardship in all forms, and you've touched on several of them, and science is absolutely central to the conservation protection of species and whole ecosystems. So how would you characterize the role of CDOC in relationship to stewardship activities? Do you see yourselves as providing information primarily to fellow scientists and the public, or is there a more directly applied or policy-relevant aspect to your work as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because a lot of people say, scientists will just polish their grain of sand forever and has no real value. And what we think of ourselves as is a place-based conservation group. So we focused on the Salish Sea. And what we say with place-based conservation, there are three tenets. You want to know it, you want to connect to it, and then people want to protect it. So if people don't know it, they're not going to get connected to it, right? And if they're not connected to it, they don't want to protect it. Mm-hmm. And science is really critical for getting people to know what's there. And then once they're connected to it, science is critical to letting them know how you can protect it, how you can make it better. And so what we've done over the last 18 or 20 years almost is said, you know, we want to publish science, we want to get science into management and policy, but we've also realized we have to do a better job of getting people connected. And so a few years ago, Audrey Benedict and I wrote a book on the Salish Sea. And we used all these beautiful photos that people took from all over the area, actually 55 different photographers, and packed that thing full of science. Excuse me. But put it in a way that's really user-friendly. It's like a National Geographic for the place where you live. So you can pick it up and read two or three pages. You can read the photo captions. And immediately you're going to be drawn in and be like, whoa, this is going on right here? And that was a really big step for us to say, you know, science also has this value. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, we thought, you know, what about getting it into the hands of kids? In fifth grade, people are learning about ecosystems. They're learning about trophic levels. You know, they're learning about photosynthesis. What if they could have examples from the Salish Sea? So Audrey and I also wrote a kid's book called Explore the Salish Sea, designed to get those concepts into them that they have to learn for the next generation science standards, but also designed to inspire them to get out to the beach, to go out with a headlamp at night, or go look under a rock, or, you know, try and identify a bird, to really get people in fifth grade connected to this place. And then the last thing that we've been doing is taking that science, and we said, wow, it's awesome, we can sell 20,000 books. That's a lot of books, but we have 8 million people. How can we get to them better? So we started working with a guy named Bob Friel and producing a YouTube program called Salish Sea Wild. Mm-hmm. And these are small 5 or 10 minute stories about some of the stuff that's out there, a run of herring or sea lions or using a submarine to discover what's down deep. And so that's exciting. So that's actually moving forward, and we're hoping to air those on PBS this fall. So we're just taking science and getting into as many components of this place-based conservation as we can.
Oh, that's great. And so, you know, having accomplished all of that and all that is ongoing, what's on the horizon for CDOC? Any near or far future plans that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, I think right now what we're thinking about, we've been around for almost 20 years, and we've had a really good run, and we have a lot of accomplishments that we've worked with partners to get going. As we're looking forward, we're saying, look, we actually want to be here and be sustained and be able to be a force in the future, because we don't think that these external pressures on the environment are going to change. And so right now, what we're really trying to do is to say, how can we try and ensure that we can be here in the long term and then do more of what we're doing, right? Because, you know, we're making some accomplishments, but we're also in kind of a constant battle against development, more people moving in, more chemicals or other things like that. So we're trying to say, how can we grow to a level where we can actually even do more than what we're doing now? So it's a weird thing to say, but we want to, because what we realize is that the accomplishments, like the one I talked about with the abalone, that started in 2004. It was 14 years for the listing. It may be another 10 years for recovery. We've got to be in this game for the long haul. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we've got to be really sustainable. And that's what we're really working on right now, is how do we continue to fund this? How do we get some more people on board? And then how do we get more of the 8 million people around here mm-hmm. on board to take care of this place? So that's our big push over the next couple of years.
That makes a lot of sense. And I want to ask you how people could support that push. But I just want to ask you one question about something you just said.
Yeah.
You said the external pressure is not going to change. And I'm just wondering about that because, like, as you mentioned, 8 million people, that's constantly changed. It's not gone in the right direction,
right.
But we've gotten more people, more pollutants, more, yeah. Et cetera. I'm assuming that's going to change one way or the other, either get worse or better.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Mark. And it has changed. And like you said, if you look at the graph of species, there's a decline. If you mm-hmm. look at the graph of most chemicals, they've gone up, and most mm-hmm. people, they've gone up. Mm-hmm. But the change is there, and it's subtle. So we are seeing a decrease in things like PCBs and DDT. Mm-hmm. It's taken a long time, but we're seeing other persistent organic pollutants like PBDEs go up. So yes. It's just this constant. I tell people, you know, that life is, you never find a balance, you're constantly balancing.
Mm.
And I think that's, for now, that's where I think we are with our ecosystem, is that we haven't quite figured out how to do it just right. And so we're kind of balancing resource extraction with resource protection and population growth with how to do it in smart ways that don't impact the things that we love right now. So I think you're right. It's constantly changing, right? And I think that until we can get everybody on board to say, hey, this is how we live here, this is how we respect this place, sure, we're going to fish, we're going to crab, we're going to harvest trees, but we're going to do it in a way that benefits us all. And that's really this kind of One Health concept that we have at the veterinary school at UC mm-hmm. Davis, that having healthy animals, healthy people, healthy ecosystems, it's good for everybody. It really mm-hmm. is a One Health that we're working for.
Great. That makes a lot of sense. So how do people support that? What can they do to support CDOC, either in terms of voluntary activity or money?
Yeah, we do have private donations. People can go to our website, and we have people that support us. And a lot of the work we do is privately supported. So a lot of the projects that we're funded, we're doing things that the government can't do, or we're looking ahead faster than they're looking ahead. So there aren't grants for things like that. The other thing I think is really important, and we forget, is get educated and talk to people about it. If you look at a newspaper, there may be one article on what's happening with the Salish Sea and 12 articles on March Madness that are going on. And so traffic, you know, schools, sports, all of these things are important as a society, but our environment is also important, but people are not talking about it. And so we want to get people talking about it so it becomes a part of who they are and how they act. And I think that's a really big thing that people can do. They forget that they can do that. Get yourself educated, and then get other people educated, and then even making very small actions. I always say, how many days a year can I ride my bike to work? Yeah, I'd love to ride it every day, but some days I can't. Mm-hmm. But even every day I ride my bike, I like to pat myself on the shoulder and say, okay, that's a little bit less carbon that I'm putting out there, right? And I'm making myself a little bit healthier, and I'm making the air a little bit better. So take those small actions and then celebrate those, I think.
That makes a lot of sense, and as opposed to the all or nothing approach.
Exactly.
And I'm right there with you as long as you're not dissing March Madness.
No, no. I love basketball. That's why that was the first example that came into my mind.
Exactly.
You know?
We pointed ourselves first. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us, Joe, and best of luck in the important work that you and CDOC are doing on behalf of the public as well as of the rich marine life surrounding us. So that's it for this week's podcast. Next week, we'll hear from the Friends of Moran State Park as my colleague Tim Gustafson joins us in interviewing the Friends of Moran and engages in an exchange of music, information, and ideas at the public picnic shelter on the shores of Cascade Lake in Moran State Park. Before I go, I'd also like to thank Lauren Kim and Salita Moran for taking part in the podcast production today. Salita and Lauren have been taking on central roles in research that we're doing on sound in Moran State Park, including hiking the trails and taking sound levels while also conducting interviews with park visitors. I was glad to see them actually be able to sit down for a few minutes instead of walking for miles taking readings with their sound pressure level meters. Perhaps some week soon we'll hear more about the work that Salita and Lauren are doing at Moran State Park. Meanwhile, we hope that you, the listeners, are getting a chance to enjoy and protect the public lands and waters near you. See you next week.